Today we're going to start a new study because I imagine I'll be up here speaking a few times. And so we finished the Gospel of John a while back. Now we're going to start a new study in the book of Judges. And I'm calling it The Cost of Conforming. How bad can it get? What do you think of, or what do you picture when you hear the word judge? What comes to your mind? Hopefully it wasn't several appearances you had before one. Some of us probably think of this, right? Some black-robed person with a gavel in their hand, ready to strike it down. Maybe you think of these popular folks these days, Supreme Court justices. Maybe you know this lady? Anybody familiar with Judge Judy? Martha read her book, and I'm pretty sure her middle name is not Grace. Because that lady has not an ounce of grace in her, I don't think. But she told a story. You know, there's a common problem in lots of households, right? Keeping the toilet seat up or down. Well, apparently she got up in the middle of the night one time, went to go to the bathroom, and the seat was up. She almost fell in. So she goes out. Now, this is the middle of the night. So she goes out into the kitchen, takes a pot, a metal spoon, goes back into the bedroom, gets up on the bed, and stands over her husband, starts beating that pot with that spoon. And I'm thinking, I think she made the comment, didn't she, that he never did that again? Maybe you think of a dog show, a judge at a dog show, judging the dogs. Of course, to be fair, Martha and I are cat people, so we had to have a cat judge too. But you know, there's all kinds of different judges. Maybe you're thinking of a judge at a county fair. You know, judging food, all kinds of things there. Lots of things to think about when you think of a judge. Well, when we go into the book of Judges, it's a little bit different. The biblical book of Judges, when we think of a judge, it's probably not what we think of. The Hebrew word is shephatim, meaning judges, rulers, deliverers, or saviors. Shephat not only carries the idea of maintaining justice and settling disputes, but it also is used to mean like liberating or setting people free. So it's a little different meaning than we normally think of when we think of the book of Judges. Well, today from Judges chapter 1, we're going to see how Israel started out fighting the enemy, but eventually ended up sparing the enemy. And I know this morning I'm going to give a lot of background information, so kind of bear with me, but it's kind of important so we can see where this book is going. But so first of all, let's kind of look at the history and setting of the judges. Well, we know what happened in Genesis. We went from paradise, didn't we, to prison. The nation starts out in the Garden of Eden. It ends up their slaves down in Egypt, right? The nation of Israel. Well, then Exodus comes along. And God raises up a guy by the name of Moses, and he delivers the people from that slavery where they were for about 430 years. And they leave Egypt, right, and they head for the Promised Land, except they don't take the straight route, do they? Because of Israel's sin, they spend 40 years wandering in the wilderness. So that's from about 1445 to 405 or so B.C. Well, then they get to the Jordan, and they're getting ready to cross over. Of course, God told Moses he can't cross over because he struck the rock one time when he was just supposed to speak to it, so he's not allowed to go into the Promised Land. But they have Joshua as their leader, right? So they're getting ready to go in. They enter Canaan, but then Joshua dies. And then what I say is the dark days and vicious cycles start with the judges. You know, when we think of the book of Judges, maybe we just think, well, that's a book in the Old Testament, but doesn't seem that important when you think of Genesis and Exodus and all of those and the books of the law, Leviticus and Deuteronomy. But, you know, that cycle, that time period of the judges is like about 350 years. So that's a pretty significant amount of time in the history of the nation of Israel, from about 1381 to roughly 1051, before they get their first king. So that's kind of the historical setting of the book. But then when we get into the book, we're going to see that there's cycles of sin, unfortunately. Israel, you know, they go into the land, they're starting to serve the Lord. They're supposed to do what they're supposed to do, and they start to serve the Lord, but then they fall into sin and idolatry, and they're not obedient to what the Lord told them to do. So guess what? They become enslaved. Another nation rises up against them, controls them, enslaves them. So what does Israel do? Well, they cry out to the Lord, which they should do. They cry out to the Lord, and then you know what? He raises up a judge, a deliverer. And so Israel's delivered. And then Israel starts serving the Lord, but then, and we start going around. There's at least seven of these cycles in the book. And I know, you know, you're thinking, well, you think they learned the lesson the first time? How many of us learned the lesson the first time? Usually not. But we're going to see this cycle. Some people have described it in different ways. You know, God gives them rest. Well, then they rebel. Then there's retribution. Then they repent. And I put several question marks because I'm not really sure they ever truly repent. And then God restores them. Or you could say, well, they start out and they fall into sin. Then they're into suffering and servitude. Then they make their supplication. And then there's salvation. God delivers them. You could say, well, they start out, they become apathetic. Then they go into apostasy. They start worshiping other gods. And then there's affliction. And then there's answered prayer. And then finally there's disobedience. They disobey God. So they're desperate because now they're being taken over by somebody else. And because in their desperation, they cry out to the Lord and he delivers them. So lots of ways to look at what we're going to see in this book. But, you know, I think it's a really relevant book. And there's one verse that kind of gets repeated a few times. Everyone did that which was right in their own eyes. Does that sound like any people we know? Everybody did that which was right in their own eyes. And then there's disobedience, bondage, misery, liberation and rest, and then compromise. So it starts all over again. So, terrible cycle, but that's what we're going to see in this book. And I just wanted to do a little comparison because it's funny. When you get done with the book of Joshua, you think, all right, you know, they're finally in the promised land. God told them for all these years, he's got a land prepared for them. They get across the Jordan River. They start taking some cities, think of the victory of Jericho, you know, the walls came tumbling down. So you're thinking, oh, great, this is good. So you think of victory. Well, then when you get to the Judges, it's really about a cycle of defeat. When you think of Joshua, you think of freedom. They're finally free. They've been enslaved for all these years. They finally get to the promised land. But then you get to the book of Judges and you see cycles of servitude. In Joshua, faith, you know, Joshua believed that the Lord would deliver them. They get to the book of Judges and it's one cycle of unbelief after another. In Joshua, there's a whole bunch of progression. They're getting into the land. They're starting to take cities. They're starting to do what they're supposed to do. You get to the book of Judges, and it's like they're going backwards. They're declining. In Joshua, you have a spiritual vision. Joshua knows what he's supposed to do, knows what he wants to do, knows what God wants them to do. But then you get to the book of Judges, and you see this earthly emphasis. They start hanging out and living with the people they're supposed to be conquering. Joshua, you think of their fidelity to the Lord. They believe the Lord. They wanted to serve and worship the Lord. You get the Judges and their apostasy. They're just turning away from the Lord. Lots of joy in the book of Joshua, lots of sorrow in the book of Judges. You see strength in the book of Joshua, conquering the enemy. You get the Judges and you see weakness. In Joshua, you can tell the whole nation was together, right? They knew they had a goal to achieve. They was very unified. They went in, they did what they were supposed to do. Then you get to Judges, and there's declension, there's anarchy. In Joshua, sin is judged by the people because it's taken seriously. You get to the book of Judges, and sin's kind of lightly regarded. Yeah, I mean, we may be doing this stuff, but kind of sounds like a civilization we know about, doesn't it? And there's some progression in the book, of course. You know, the first part of it, there's basically an explanatory prologue, and we'll see that. Then there's the main body, and then there's an illustrative epilogue. First, you start out with some apathy, then it turns to apostasy, and eventually it turns to anarchy. So deterioration, deliverance, and then depravity. Then we're going to see the causes of the cycles. Well, a lot of the cycles were caused because of failure to complete the conquest of Canaan. In fact, they decided they were comfortable living with the Canaanites. Well, then you're going to see the curse of the cycles, and there's the seven cycles I talked about, and they're going to end up actually, which they should do, warring with the Canaanites. And then you're going to see living like the Canaanites, the depravity of Israel in the time of the judges. Those are the conditions in those cycles. And so, like I said, it's a long period of their history. But that's kind of what we're going to see in this book. And somebody coined this phrase, and I think it's a good phrase. One thing in the book to look for is what he called progressive Canaanization, as opposed to what I call progressive sanctification. And you know, Dale talked about this, I think, just last week. When we become a believer, we're saved, right? We become a child of God, but the process of growth takes place for the rest of our life, and that's the process of sanctification. So in Romans 12, 2, Paul says, "And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may approve what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." So do not be conformed to this world. So we're going to see what happens when the nation of Israel moves into a land, how they kind of become conformed and what the result of that is. So I guess we better start with, what was Israel supposed to do? According to Deuteronomy 6, what were they supposed to do? Well, we know that they were supposed to love and obey Jehovah. They were supposed to love and obey Jehovah as the only true God. So Deuteronomy 6, "These are the commands, decrees, and laws the Lord your God directed me to teach you to observe in the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess. Hear, Israel, and be careful to obey so that it may go well with you and that you may increase greatly in a land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord, the God of your ancestors, promised you. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength." So that's pretty plain, right? Everything you have, everything you do, everything you want to achieve, put me first. All your heart, not a divided heart, all your strength, all your soul, 100%. Secondly, "I want you to teach your children God's laws." So he says in Deuteronomy 6, 7, "Impress them," that is the law of God, "impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up." Now that's pretty plain too, right? Teach them my law. Besides that, he wants them to be thankful. Be thankful for God's blessings. Yeah, in Deuteronomy 6:10, "When the Lord your God brings you into the land he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, a land with large, flourishing cities you did not build, houses filled with all kinds of good things you did not provide, wells you did not dig, and vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant, then when you eat and are satisfied, be careful that you do not forget the Lord, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery." Don't forget the Lord. You're going to go into this land, and I like the way he says this here. You're going to have vineyards you didn't plant. You're going to have olive groves you didn't plant. You're going to have houses you didn't build. I'm providing all of this for you. All you have to do is do what I say. Sounds simple, right? So obey, teach, and be thankful. Then he says, "Separate yourselves from the pagan worship of the Canaanites." Separate yourself from the pagan worship of the Canaanites. Verse 14 of Deuteronomy 6, "Do not follow other gods, the gods of the peoples around you. For the Lord your God who is among you is a jealous God, and his anger will burn against you, and he will destroy you from the face of the land. Do not put the Lord your God to the test, as you did at Massa," and we know what happened there. They cried out to the Lord. They didn't have the water they wanted. So, again, sounds simple. When you get into the land, you know who the true God of the universe is, because I picked you, Israel, as a nation. I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians. I took you out of slavery. I've given you this promised land flowing with milk and honey. Don't forget me. Well, you'd think, well, they wouldn't do that, would they? I mean, So the good news is, they start out fighting the enemy. That's the good news. They start out fighting the enemy. Each tribe's land grant was established in Joshua already. So when they got into the land, they already knew that the tribe of Judah goes here, the tribe of Simeon goes here, the tribe of Issachar goes here. They already knew where they were supposed to go, so that's a good thing. However, they didn't drive out all the enemies. So when they got into the land and they knew where they were supposed to go, one minor little detail, they didn't drive out the enemies. So Israel owned all the land, the Lord gave it to them, but they did not possess all the land. They didn't take it over like they were supposed to. They had it, it was theirs, just up to them to possess it. And I don't know how well you can see this map, but this map is a breakdown of where the tribes are supposed to go. So you can see, and the one thing I wanted to point out, that green section at the bottom, that's where Judah was supposed to be, but Simeon is also in there, so that'll come up in a little bit. But that's kind of it's kind of the map of, they knew where they were supposed to go as tribes. So verse 1 of Judges 1, we finally got there. Verse 1 of Judges 1, after the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked the Lord, "Well, who of us is to go up first to fight against the Canaanites?" Well, the Lord answered, "Judah shall go up. I have given the land into their hands." So the men of Judah, they said to the Simeonites, their fellow Israelites, "Come up with us into the territory allotted to us to fight against the Canaanites. Well, we in turn will go with you into yours." So the Simeonites went with them. So good news is, at first, Israel sought the Lord. That's a good thing. Okay, Lord, who do you want to go first? Who do you want to go into the land start? That's a good thing. They sought the Lord. Well, he tells them, he says, well, Judah. And so Judah does that. They obey the Lord. They go into the land to start taking over the land and engaging the enemy. But now they ask the tribe of Simeon to go with them. And like I showed on that map, Simeon and Judah, their territory overlapped. So there was that reason that they should ask them. But also Leah was the mother of Judah and the mother of Simeon. So those two tribes were like blood brothers, okay? Plus, like I mentioned before, the inheritance was within the land of Judah. So Judah just said, since your land is with ours, why don't you come help us, and then when you need to engage, we'll help you. That sounds fair. Because there was no leader during that time. Joshua was dead now. So there's nobody looking over all the tribes as one leader. Nobody. So the tribes may not have been working together. And we'll see that they weren't. So verse 4 of chapter 1. So when Judah attacked, the Lord gave the Canaanites and Perizzites into their hands. And they struck down 10,000 men at Bezek. It was there that they found Adoni-Bezek and fought against him, putting to rout the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Adoni-Bezek fled, but they chased him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and his big toes. Then Adoni-Bezek said, "Well, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off have picked up scraps under my table. Now God has paid me back for what I did to them." They brought him to Jerusalem and he died there. So Judah now starts having some victories. That's a good thing. First, they sought the Lord. Who should go? Well, Judah. Well, Judah goes in and they're starting to be victorious with God's help. They defeat two tribes. They defeated the Canaanites. They captured one of the kings. And that's kind of funny. But we say, well, he cut off his big toes and his thumbs. Why would they do that? I don't think you'd be much of good as a soldier if you had no thumbs and no big toes. But also, he did the same thing to 70 other people. So he's being repaid for what he had done. Kind of strange, but... Well, then they next conquer Jerusalem. But the trouble is, they don't quite occupy it. They conquer it, but there's still people there that aren't from Israel. So they did take the city of Debir, under the leadership of Othniel, and we'll see him later. And Othniel happens to be Caleb's nephew. He's a judge we'll talk about later on. But Othniel was given Caleb's daughter as his wife. So he'll be an important person later in the book. But so they're starting to have victories. They're starting to do what they were supposed to do. They're in the land. They're fighting. They're engaging the enemy. The Lord's granting them victories. That's a good thing. The Kenites left Jericho, and they dwelt with Israel. And then they destroyed the city of Zephath, and they turned to the Philistines, the cities of Gaza, Ashkelon and Ekron. Now, they were able to take, it says in the text, they were able to take the hill country, but because the Philistines had iron chariots, they couldn't defeat them in the low country. So they couldn't quite get the job done there. Verse 22, now the tribes of Joseph attacked Bethel, and the Lord was with them. When they sent men to spy out Bethel, formerly called Luz, the spies saw a man coming out of the city, and they said to him, show us how to get into the city, and we will see that you are treated well. So he showed them, and they put the city to the sword, but spared the man and his whole family. So now Joseph is starting to engage, and Joseph is having a victory, the victory of Joseph. And that tribe conquered the city of Bethel. And you know, Bethel, in the history of Israel, was a pretty important place. So in the victories of Judah and Joseph, one phrase reoccurs. The Lord was with them. The Lord was with them. Do we want to have victory in this world? Guess what has to happen? The Lord has to be with us. How many of us want to try to do stuff on our own strength? We don't even consider the Lord. And how does that work out? He is essential. The Lord has to be with us. So unfortunately, they start out fighting the enemy, but now we're going to see them sparing the enemy. And again, I want to go back to Deuteronomy 7. The tribes did not heed Deuteronomy 7. We looked at Deuteronomy 6 before. Now let's look at Deuteronomy 7. So they were to conquer the inhabitants and utterly destroy them. What? They were to make no covenants with them, and they were to show them no mercy. Deuteronomy 7, 1-2. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, seven nations larger and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy. Now, that seems kind of harsh, doesn't it? But the Lord, of course, knows what he's doing. So they didn't do that. They were not to marry them. Verse 7, 3, and 4 in Deuteronomy 7. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons. Why? For they will turn your children away from following me to serve other gods. And the Lord's anger will burn against you, and you will, and they will quickly, and will quickly destroy you. Okay, so don't intermarry. When you get into the land, don't intermarry. Utterly destroy them. Show them no mercy. Also, I want you to destroy all the pagan worship items. All the items that they used to worship, verse 5 of Deuteronomy 7, but thus you shall deal with them. You shall destroy their altars, break down their sacred pillars, and cut down their wooden images, and burn down their carved images with fire. So I don't want any remnant of their false worship system left. I want you to completely destroy everything, burn it all up, get rid of all of it. I don't want you to keep any of it. Also, they were not to covet the gold and silver of the enemies. Because now, remember, they're going into a land where these nations have lived for a long time. And they have houses, and they have things they've acquired. So they're going to see some stuff, some gold, some silver, who knows what all they're going to see. So the Lord tells them in Deuteronomy 7, you shall not covet the silver or the gold that is on them, nor take it for yourselves, lest you be snared by it. For it is an abomination to the Lord your God. And they were not to bring an abomination into their house. Nor shall you bring an abomination into your house, lest you be doomed to destruction like it. You shall utterly detest it and utterly abhor it, for it is an accursed thing. So I'm assuming he's talking about here any small idols or anything that they have. Hey, this is precious. Maybe it's silver or gold. It's an idol, but it's probably worth something. Let's take it into our house. No. Don't take anything into your house. So we read these instructions and they seem pretty clear, right? What they're supposed to do. Utterly destroy the enemy, show them no mercy. Does that sound harsh? And you know, I think some people, what if this was today? Ooh, that would be bad, right? You know, talk about justice. We talk a lot about justice, don't we? If somebody told somebody to destroy everybody and destroy everything, and here's one thing I've learned. Ready for this? God is God. He can do what he wants. If he wants to destroy the world with the flood, guess what? He can destroy the world with a flood. Until we come to the place when we say he's God, he can do what he wants, we're going to have a hard time. But we know why he did it here, and we'll see what happens because they don't. So anyway, so unfortunately now, the tribes do not do as they were commanded to do. Manasseh did not finish the job at Beth Shean. These other cities, Tanakh, Dor, Ibleam, Megiddo, they didn't finish the job there. And unfortunately, they end up actually, now those tribes, they ended up paying tribute to Israel. I mean, they were at least subjected enough that they were taxed and they were able to pay, but they were still in the land. They were still there. And that was kind of the whole point, for them not to be. The Canaanites continued to live there. That wasn't what the Lord said, was it? Ephraim, same thing. They did not drive out the Canaanites in Gezer. So Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or Nahalol. The Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Akko or Sidon or Alab or Akzib or Helba or Aphek or Rahab. I mean, you can just see the list here. Unfortunately, none of the tribes did what they were supposed to do. In fact, Dan was even forced into the mountains by the Amorites. They were fleeing. So unfortunately, they got into the land, but they didn't follow what the Lord said. Now, and again, you know, I'm standing up here and I'm saying this like why they should have, but I'm also saying, you know, they were wandering around for a long time. How much battle experience had they had? Not much, right? So if the Lord tells them to go in and go to battle, that's not going to be something that's, you know, firsthand for them to do. They don't have the experience doing that. So I'm not saying it would be easy to do. You know, if you're Israel and you're thinking, okay, and they look around and all these people are there and they got to get rid of all these people, they don't even have a standing army, that would be a little tricky. But the Lord also promised them one thing, right? I'll be with you. I'll be with you. The first step towards defeat was neglecting God's word. It kind of always is, isn't it? The first step towards defeat is neglecting God's word. This new generation that's coming into the land did not heed Deuteronomy 7. So I asked the question before, was God unjust? Was it unjust of God to do this? Well, two things I think we can point out. First of all, they were wicked nations. And we'll see how wicked they were, but these were wicked nations. They worshiped Baal and Asheroth, gods of fertility. They would have sexual privileges with as a part of their quote-unquote worship. I mean, these were wicked cultures. So God had been patient with them for a long time, right? He'd put up with this for a long time. And second of all, I want to point out, these nations had seen what God had done. They knew that this nation of Israel had been delivered from Egypt. They knew that God was a pretty strong God. They saw what happened at Jericho. They knew what Israel had done. They knew about their past. And yet, they continued on. Even when the nation of Israel showed up, they didn't care. So, like I said, God's God, but I think these are, you know, God was very patient with all these nations. So the question is today, we're not fighting the Amalekites or the Jebusites or the Perizzites or the Hivites or the Amalekites. Who's our enemy today? Ephesians 2, Paul talks about that. As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins, in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. All of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our flesh and following its desires and thoughts. Like the rest, we were by nature deserving of wrath. So who are our enemies today? Well, first of all, the world system, right? The prevailing opinions of right and wrong in the world. And guess what? It's mostly not right, is it? The opinions of the world are mostly wrong, mostly unbiblical. But that's the world system that we live in, right? It's all right, you know, to murder babies. It's all right to fill in the blank. I don't know, whatever we're seeing in our culture now. The world system that we deal with every day. How about the flesh? We also deal with the flesh every day. The desires that we have that we want to fulfill apart from God's will for us. The desires that we have that we want to fulfill apart from God's will for us. The flesh is always with us, isn't it? And then the devil, of course, Paul calls him the prince of the power of the air, who actually orchestrates everything opposed to Christ. So yeah, we have enemies today. The world system, the flesh, and the devil himself. We're facing those enemies every day. So how are we doing against the enemy? Are we fighting them? Do we even recognize them when they show up? Do we even know who the enemy is? And if so, what are we doing when we see the enemy rear its ugly head? What do we say to our flesh? What do we say to the world system? And obviously we know who's behind all of it, and that's Satan. How do we attack Satan, by the way? Through the Lord, right? That's the only way. Have we started sparing the enemy, so to speak? Have we started, yeah, the world system's not bad. Yeah, I can give into my flesh every now and then. I can hit that website or do whatever I'm not supposed to be doing. I can do that. It won't hurt me. I'm going to close with this, but this is kind of the cycle of men and nations. And when we look at this, it's kind of, we can see what's happened in our country. And I had to study a lot of history in my undergrad and grad degrees. So you can see it in Rome. You can see it in Greece. You can see it in a lot of nations. But like this country, how did it get started? Well, people were in bondage to the king, right? Well, so a lot of people had Christian faith. They came to this country to set up a country. So they turn to the Lord when they're in bondage. And then, because they have spiritual faith, guess what that gives them? Great courage. So we can come across the ocean, for example, here in this country. We can start a new country. We know what we want to do. We know what we believe. Let's just start a new country. Great courage. And then, from courage to liberty. Once they have to take the step that they need to take, they realize they have freedom now. Oh, we're not under bondage by anybody else. Nobody else is controlling us now. So we have liberty. And once we have liberty, we started having abundance, right? Everything starts, the Lord's blessing, everything's happening. We're just rich with everything. We have all the things we need and more. But then, because we're still fallen human beings, we turn to selfishness, don't we? I might not have enough. Even though I have more than most everybody in the world, I don't quite have enough. I want more. So then, from selfishness to complacency. Well, you know, I have everything I need. Maybe I want more. I don't know if I'll get it, but I'm satisfied. I'm happy with what I have. I don't need to make noise. From complacency to apathy. I don't care anymore. I don't care. I know a lot of stuff's going on, but I don't really care. I'm not going to do anything about it. What can I do about it? I'm just one person. It's going to happen anyway. From apathy to dependency. Oh, someone wants to take control of you then, huh? Someone else comes in. Yeah, that probably happens. Yeah, a lot. And then from dependency, back to bondage. And if you look at this list, you can see nation after nation. This is exactly what happens. given enough time. Yeah, we're fighting an enemy today. The world, the flesh, and the devil, we're fighting those enemies. Ultimately, we know it's not the people. You know, Dale did a whole study in Ephesians 6, remember, on the whole armor of God. Those are the weapons we use against those enemies. We can't stop fighting. We can't stop fighting. That's what we're called to do here. Let's stand for prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this portion of your word. We realize, Father,